Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 10, World War Kaiju Creative Team Interview. Today I interview the team who's creating the comic World War Kaiju. Now you can find out more about this comic over at World War Kaiju, and Kaiju is spelled KAIJU.com. World War Kaiju is created by Josh Finney, artist Matrick Pacavoy, and Kat Rocha, all three of which are on the interview that I'm doing. Now, this is the first interview I've done for Solitaire Rose Radio. There are other interviews that I'm hoping to do, but one of the things I wanted to do with Solitaire Rose Radio, as I've said a lot of times, is this is about stories, whether it's stories of things that I know about, things that I'm researching, comic creators, comic companies, stories that I think people would like, but it's all about stories. One of the things I really dislike in a lot of interviews, and I call it the Jay Leno syndrome, is that people have really kind of been coached on how to do interviews. And I always think back to when I was young and heavily influenced. It was when David Letterman started his show. Now, I'd watched Carson. I'd enjoyed Carson. I really liked Carson. And when he got to the interviews, he was one of those people who you could actually sit and watch the interview and it would be an interesting back and forth. And Carson was a master of letting the other person tell their story and jumping in when he needed to move the conversation or help the person get a laugh. Carson never got a laugh at the other person's expense. Letterman did. And for years, Letterman, on his NBC show, got the, well, you know, he's really funny, but he can't interview. I disagreed. I enjoyed his interview style. I thought it was more suited for when he was on. But when Jay Leno came on to The Tonight Show, I watched a few, because at the time, I liked Leno. I was a little miffed that Letterman didn't get the spot, but I liked Leno. And Leno was a terrible interviewer. He was just terrible. And I read the book The Late Shift. And what happened was, because Leno wasn't very good at interviews, but NBC really liked him on the monologue, and they really liked his personality, and they thought that he really connected. So what they would do, they brought in a team who would pre-interview. Now, Carson had pre-interviews, but Leno's pre-interview, they would sit down with the person or their publicist and map out how the interview would go. It would be, okay, we're going to have one or two funny stories. You're going to talk about your project. And in your project, you're going to have a funny story. And that went beautifully for the people in Hollywood or in book publishing or any other publishing to kind of put their person in the best light. You don't go on Leno to think you're going to get ambushed. Leno's going to ask your softball questions that you already know the answers to. So a lot of actors especially would memorize their bits and go on and tell the story. And that kind of became how those interviews are. You have a 7-minute segment, all right? You come on, you're given setup for your story, you do your pub, you get off. I don't care for that. I haven't watched Leno since probably 93, 94. I don't care for his style of interview. I don't care for the pre-canned interview. When I watch The Daily Show, if it's a celebrity or someone on pushing something, I don't even watch the interview. I delete that episode when it gets to that because I know it's pre-scripted, it's pre-planned. Now, when he'll get on political guests or he'll get on authors on The Daily Show, he'll take some time and he'll dig in. And I won't say he'll be combative, but he will not just do a puff piece. Moving over to podcasts, which is what I do, there are podcasts now, some of which where it's long-form interviews, some of which where it's shorter interviews. But I've listened to a lot of podcasts where Joe Brony is going to be taking over the new Wolverine series. And Joe Brony goes out and does the interview circuit on the podcasts and on videocasts and all these interviews. And they're all the same. Oh, I'm so excited to be working on this book. I've been reading this book since I was a kid. I cannot wait to do this book. I've got some new twists on the character. We're going to have a fight with all of his old villains, but it's going to be different. And that's fine and good, and it's got a place, and I understand it, and I don't want to do it. I want to do more of the stuff like on The Art of Wrestling, or Mark Maron's WTF, or podcasts like that. One of the guys who's really, really good is Mike Johnson at PWInsider.com. Become an elite member if you're a wrestling fan in any way. The interviews he does, he'll come in with his prep questions, but he's really good at turning it into a conversation. Colt Cabana, because he works in wrestling, when he interviews wrestlers, he turns it into a conversation. Mark Maron, it's a conversation. He has learned that skill. I've listened to some of the real early ones, and you can tell that he's got the, you know, a few pre-scripted questions, and he moves on. That's the other thing I don't like. I don't like the people who, I have my list of 30 questions, and no matter what the answer is to the question, I'm going to go to the next one on the list, rather than dig in a little, find out a little more. So, I was contacted by Kat Rocha, who said, hey, we've got this Kickstarter thing. Would you be interested in doing an interview? And I didn't tell them this. I know they'll hear it when I didn't immediately jump on. Now, I've listened to interviews with Josh and Kat, and they're very personable. They've got great stories. They're really good at making you interested in their books. I remember I listened to an interview with them on Comic Geek Speak about Titanium Rain, and by the time they were done, they had talked me into the building. I could not wait. Take my money now. And I bought the two issues of the comic, and then they had some publishing delays, and I waited, and I got the collected version, and it's one of my favorite books because it's hard science fiction. There's not that much of that. But it's also hard science fiction where I don't need to read 7, 8, 9, 10 novels to get a whole story. It's complete. It leaves you wanting more. I already knew that they had good stories, they were good in interviews, but I wanted to know a little more about this project. So I went to the website and I looked at the project, and I'm excited about it. Hopefully that comes through in the interview. And as you listen to the interview, and he talks about kaiju are the Japanese big monsters like Godzilla and Rodan and Ghidra and Gamera, and I've liked those movies. But these guys really put it in a new perspective for me. A lot like when I watched spaghetti westerns when my dad was a fan of westerns. And he didn't care if it was an Italian western. It's a western. Don't care. And then in college, we watched The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And the teacher put the spaghetti westerns in perspective for me. I understood why they were filmed the way they were, why the imagery was the way it was, why they had that look, the history of the genre in the, I know some people say, well, you need to call them Euro Westerns. I've always heard spaghetti Westerns. I'm always going to call them spaghetti Westerns. So when it comes to kaiju, I knew about them. I can't say that I'm a huge fan. I read the comic. I watch the movies. I enjoy the movies. Well, okay, the American Godzilla movie was probably the worst movie I've paid money to see on the first day. I remember going to see that movie with Joe and his partner, Pat Gruber, who's a huge Godzilla fan, and a few other people. And when the lights came up, I actually looked at Gruber and said, I really think you need to give me my money back because that was just a waste of my time. And Pat said, I didn't like that movie that much. I'll probably only see it 3 or 4 more times in the theater. So I went to the site and I looked through. First off, when it says, "What if Dr. Strangelove created Godzilla?" that's enough to hook me. But there's a preview on the page, there's a lot of information on the page, and Josh talks about it far better than I ever do. Now, this is a two-part episode. The first part is the entire team, where we have Patrick with us, and the second part I'll be posting tomorrow. Patrick had to leave, so I just talked more with Josh and Kat. And as I'm listening to the interview to mix it, I got very interested and very fascinated again. So I'm very happy about the work that Josh and Patrick and Kat put in on their end to make this episode good. So here you go. Here's the first part of the interview for World War Kaiju. Well, I've got a crowd with me. This is the first interview for Solitaire Rose Radio.
Oh, wow.
And oddly enough, it all came together within the last week, whereas the other interviews I've been trying to get, I think there's one I've been working on for about 4 months. And the Don McGregor interview, he keeps saying, "Well, once I get thus and such done," and that was 2 years ago. But you guys move fast. Why don't we go around the room? You can introduce yourself. If you've ever done a job interview, you know how they say to give an elevator speech where you tell information about yourself as if you're in an elevator with somebody who can give you a job. Why don't we just do that? We'll start with Josh.
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot here. All right. My name is Josh Finney. I primarily consider myself an author, although I am occasionally an artist. I've been at this since getting out of college, and I write sci-fi, horror, and now I'm trending towards the bizarre with a Cold War monster paranoia story.
All right, Kat.
My name is Kat Rocha. I am an artist, an aspiring writer, editor, and co-owner of 01 Publishing, where we publish the highest quality in science fiction and horror graphic novels and prose books.
And Patrick.
Patrick?
Patrick.
Hi, I'm Patrick. I'm very good at leaving my mute button on. But aside from that, I'm an artist illustrator, and I'm doing the art on World War Kaiju, and I've done art for lots of games and a little bit of comics. I worked on the Game of Thrones collectible card game for a few years, and I worked on the Call of Cthulhu and Arkham Asylum products and did dozens, if not hundreds, of cards for those properties and many others. And let's see, what is my elevator pitch? I'm like Harry Potter meets Debbie Does Dallas.
Now, on the job interviews I go on, you probably wouldn't get that job.
You are in the wrong business.
Well, I want to talk first about this World War Kaiju.
All
I
right.
was when I heard about the project, the first thing that popped into my mind is it seems like kaiju is kind of bubbling up in the cultural consciousness. There have been times when, oh, vampires are hot and this is hot, and right now we're in a time where zombies are hot. I don't remember when it was, but kaiju was in a place where even the Godzilla people in Japan, they did Godzilla Final Battle. And said, "This is the last Godzilla for a while. We're going to rest. We're going to rest the property." Now IDW's doing Godzilla. You have a new Godzilla movie coming out next year. Pacific Rim is coming out in a few weeks. And to me, it feels like you guys are kind of catching the wave. So what is it about kaiju that captured your imagination and made you think, "I want to do a story about big giant monsters stomping on stuff"?
Okay, well, I can answer both questions. That's actually kind of a two-part answer that you're going to get. Why World War Kaiju? Why now? Actually, this story had been around for almost 2 years. I was coming off of Titanium Rain 2, and I really needed to get out of the bleak headspace of writing a war story like that. So once the book was done, it was in the can, I thought, okay, you know what, let's just step back. Let's take a journey to some of the more fonder memories of my childhood and start watching all the Godzilla and Gamera films. Well, I started out with watching the newly released Japanese cut of Godzilla. Can I cuss?
Yes.
Holy shit.
Yes. It's a very different movie from the one with Raymond Burr.
Well, the American one is a good film. But, you know, growing up, I realized that was one they rarely showed on TV. It was all the other ones, the sillier ones. And but, yeah, the Japanese version had all these references, you know, mentions of Nagasaki in it. The ending is not nearly the, you know, the American one has a very post-World War II ending. You know, the apocalypse was here, we fought it, now we're on top of the world, we're okay. The Japanese version says, no, we killed this one, but there's no reason that another one's going to rise up out of the ocean if we don't stop testing nukes. Is, in fact, we're certain more will come.
Yes.
And so it was pretty dark. Beyond that, it was really dark. That really started getting me thinking. I had kind of a vague sense of how this symbol for the atom bomb became kind of a goofy hero, in a sense, in the later films. And a lot of that had to do with Japan's, for, you know, Godzilla went from being just a symbol of the bomb to kind of Japan's relationship with the U.S. We were sometimes a hero, sometimes a villain. We were their protector, whether they liked it or not, so we often did more damage than good. We were Godzilla. And, you know, it's like a lot, I'm a writer. A lot of what I do, I get deeply obsessed with whatever I'm into at the time, and I research the hell out of it. Did a lot of really critical reading and kept coming across this notion that a lot of the monsters in the Toho movies were symbols for world superpowers. Mothra is Japan. Rodan, and to some degree Anguirus, was Russia. And then, although controversial, I think it is, King Ghidorah is China. And even going so far as he has three tails and two heads, the five kingdoms. And you realize this, and you realize that there's actually, as fun and kind of campy as the other movies are, there is a deeper meaning, and there's a whole language of subtext to these fun films. One night, I'm lying in bed, and I was thinking, well, you know, what if the atom bomb had never been created? You know, what if when they split the atom at Alamogordo, what crawled out of the Trinity test site was this huge 50-foot apocalypse monster that they were looking at instead of the atom bomb being created? And bam, I started forming in my head this idea for a Cold War based around a kaiju arms race. Kat and I had gone on a vacation. She was out shopping at these various stores. I'm sitting, what was it, in the waiting area? She's changing clothes. In the space of an afternoon with a notebook, I had written the rough draft to the Cuban Monster Crisis.
And she bought a lot of clothes, apparently.
Answer, oh, come on.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how the story just came about. Why now? You know, we were two years ahead of the curve. I kind of wish we had gotten it done sooner, but we'll get to that. Anyway, story was off and rolling. Why now? Why kaiju? Why now? Culturally speaking, I've got a few answers for that, and that comes also through the research. Japan is a nation that is a volcanic island. And so natural disasters were kind of a norm for them. You know, they also had to deal with invaders. You know, their culture lent itself to this kind of nature rising up and doing terrible things to them. Anyone can look at the last, you know, the new millennium, and it has not been easy. It has not been easy on Japan. It has not been easy on the world. And a lot of these tensions have risen up. I think our headspace, our culture has definitely embraced a lot of the Japanese pop. Yeah, we've definitely embraced a lot of the Japanese pop culture.
But Kaiju itself is kind of... Okay.
God, this is going to be a long answer. One thing that America has continually gotten wrong with giant or with Kaiju specifically, the Roland Emmerich Horde Matthew Broderick Godzilla completely failed with this. Sorry, everyone. Cloverfield completely failed with this. And one thing that Hollywood keeps missing when they try and do Kaiju-type films is Kaiju are not big animals. The tradition of the classic American giant monster movie, typically, with the few exceptions being King Kong, which created the Kaiju genre, all of the giant monsters in most American films are still big animals doing what animals do. What makes a Kaiju specific is it actually digs deep into Shintoism and Japanese mythology, even kind of goes back to the yokai monsters. These aren't just big animals. These are avenging nature spirits. These are embodiments of fear and the world itself rising up due to, you know, various environmental factors. And environmental, I mean nations. They symbolize nations. They symbolize environmental disasters. They symbolize tsunamis.
Well, hey, Gamera himself is constantly like this defender of the environment. That's a continual theme with Gamera.
Oh, yeah. In the revamp, he actually is a elemental, genetically engineered elemental, but an elemental.
And don't forget, yeah. Godzilla fought the smog monster.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the greatest cinematic pieces of, let's call it Triumph of Garbage ever.
That is a weird film. I enjoyed it, but a weird film. So,
and Gamera is friend to all children, as those of us who are MST3K fans are keenly aware.
And he's made of turtle meat.
He is
yes.
Turtle meat.
Oh.
Now, coming at the Kaiju from my perspective, one thing I've noticed, I'm a wrestling fan, and I recently, like within the last 5-6 years, learned a lot about the Japanese style of wrestling. So when you watch a lot of the later Godzilla movies and the later Kaiju movies, they're playing off of the traditions and the symbols of the Japanese wrestling, including putting in characters like Jaguar and other of the masked hero wrestlers.
Well, actually, with that, did you know that the guy in the Mila costume, Mila Godzuki, is a midget wrestler?
Yes.
Yeah.
And a lot of the weird things, the goofy things Godzilla did were actually like the wrestling victory dance, the weird hitting the note. Yeah. Yeah, it was bizarre, but very entertaining.
I just, and for my own, there was a hardcore wrestling style that came up in the 90s, and it's odd that Godzilla never got into that with the barbed wire and the ultra violence. You would think that with the cross-cultural contamination, it would have gone over into it, but the Godzilla movies were kind of on their own path by that point.
Well, I think that, you know, tradition is kind of a big thing in Japan. I think by that point, a tradition had been established, and there were certain things that were going to be honored, down to the fact that even the new Godzilla was at the 2014 production. Toho is very serious about maintaining the guy in the suit look, or creaturemation or pseudomation, so that even though the creature will be CG'd, they're going to have the mocap, it's going to be a person. And I've heard they're going to rig him up to so he moves like a guy in a suit. That's what I've heard.
That's great.
I wanted to throw in one more thing, Corey, about the difference between U.S. films and Japanese films, what the difference between a giant animal and a kaiju is. Real quickly, the other things that people keep, or U.S. keeps getting wrong on this, kaiju are, again, they're not big animals. They have a defined, definite personality. They have an agenda, and they tend to lash out at civilization and technology. It's not there is a reason every time Godzilla rises up, he smashes an oil refinery. Done.
And, I do have to say that, just to bring it back to World War Kaiju, Josh was very adamant about trying to get Patrick specifically to be the artist on this because, honestly, Patrick's artwork is phenomenal. We don't know anybody anywhere that have the beautiful techniques that Patrick puts into his work and also be able to capture a little bit of that campiness.
Well, early on, we were like, who's going to do this art? Because, you know, art style just was not going to work for it. And I kept thinking, who are we going to get? I want to get Patrick. I want to get Patrick. There's no way we're going to get Patrick. Kat's all, why don't you just call him and ask him?
Well, it was also I'm part of the reason that we've been a couple of years in the making because they did call and ask me and I said, this is great. Don't get anyone else to do it. And then I proceeded to not do it for 2 years. So
there
is that they took a chance that I would have time and they blew it. So. But I have been working on it. I've done a lot of groundwork, as you can see on the site. I've done a lot of pages already and extensive character design. Because again, as Josh was saying, the thing about the kaiju is that they all have to have really specific personalities and they have to represent certain things. Plus the fact that it is generally speaking a parody. So we were taking. You know, pretty darn near every giant monster that's been in the Japanese movies and some from other countries even, and done sort of our parody version of that. And when I say parody, World War Kaiju is a pretty dry parody, but it is definitely definitely to be taken a little tongue-in-cheek, you know, like we did the our version of the British kaiju, you know, I slapped a monocle on him to focus his laser eye. And you know, the French have a giant slug, you know, things like that. So we've been on a lot of groundwork over the last couple of years, creating just the right monsters and just the right feel as we go.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing. For the kaiju fans, the hardcore fans out there, I would say that the tone of the story, it is dry. It's definitely got the Josh Finney, as Patrick put it, dry humor. But then, you know, we kind of wanted to make sure that there was the Shinichi Sekizawa gonzo bizarre shit, too. And again, for the people who aren't in the know, a lot of the Godzilla films, it was a group effort. You had this director, Ishiro Honda, was a very good director, very serious director, a lot of heart, he was the one that really gave these films a human aspect and made the characters real. Shinichi Sekizawa was the scriptwriter who created all the really, really bizarre off-the-wall, your cockroach aliens and, you know, cyborg, cyber chicken kaijus and.
Okay.
Yeah, he's the one who, you know, the diabolical plan is to build a theme park, you know, that's him.
The aliens, yeah, the alien cockroaches that build a theme park to take over the world.
Well, Patrick, you were brought in after the kind of the idea was hatched.
Mm-hmm.
And from what you've talked about, you've worked in fantasy, you've worked in horror. What was it about this where you went, I have to draw this?
Well, boy, it's got everything I like. It's got
– It was by high heels.
It was
– Well, there's that.
Yeah, that was mostly it. No, and that's everything I like. So that's it in a nutshell. it's got, giant monsters. It's got the ability to, design a lot of creative creatures, which I've always enjoyed doing. And it's got that sense of wackiness, and I really can't beat that out of my art, no matter what I try. I always have something a little on the goofy side. And so it's got that, and it's a period piece. And I am a real, fan and student of, illustration throughout the 20th century.
I have to cut in real quick. Patrick is so finicky about making sure that that is accurate that the shot of the Enola Gay flying has the correct moon phase in it.
Oh, okay. So you're in the Harvey Kurtzman school of if it's not accurate, you tear up the page, yell at the artist, and tell him to do it again, except it's yourself.
Exactly, yeah.
Plays good.
I have to admit, I have a bit of the perfectionist in me.
Okay.
Although I don't try to let that extend to the finished art. It's more in the preparation. I don't like art that's too perfectionist, you know, too overly polished and overly wrought. Although, some people might already say that about my art, but I try to keep, you know, the final product on the page is vigorous and quick, but all of the preparation is pretty substantial. And so, you know, it had all of that going for it. I was able to do that. There's little things throughout where we switch to sort of an illustration style, or we're going to do, you know, illustrations in the style of whatever day it is. And so that added a nice spice to it. And again, I really like the period stuff. So doing period costumes, we're getting to do the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, as well as sort of the, you know, the awesome Japanese sci-fi spy movie 60s look is going to be coming in too. So all things that I just really like. So there was no way I could say no. Plus,
that
they were
cool.
Yeah, and they were really nice about just giving me a ton of leeway on the character design. I was able to, you know, sit around for a couple of months, and every time I had a spare couple of hours, I could just work on a design, and they were really supportive, and you know, hardly any notes, and the ones they did have were really helpful. So it was just a super fun design process.
Well, the nice thing about working with Patrick is, you know, he gets it. He absolutely gets it. And there were numerous times where, you know, we'd send him sketches or we'd just write a vague description. And he'd come back and he'd take it to 11. He'd say, well, or what if we did this? And it was like always his instinct on it was right. You know?
Well, there we go. That's teamwork.
And that, you know, like myself, he has a very, very solid knowledge of that era and history. And that was very much a requirement for this piece.
One of the things you talk about is how you have things that happen in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And if I remember right on the Kickstarter, how many pages is the initial version of this going to be?
Well, the bare minimum would be 80 pages.
Okay. So that's a lot of plot in 80 pages.
Yeah.
We're up to the challenge.
Okay.
And you were going to ask how it's going to be done?
No, I was, because I've read Titanium Rain and I've read Utopias, and you're very good at packing a lot of information in, not just in, because a lot of writers put it in dense text where you look at the page and you might as well be reading a novel. But especially in Titanium Rain, you give a lot of information visually to the reader to kind of create the world. With World War Kaiju, and you've got 80 pages, just for those of us who like writing, how does it go script to page? Do you give a lot of detail to him where it's okay in this panel, here's all the reference material, or is it more you're giving Patrick kind of the idea and the world and letting him shape the detail?
I have my perception of what I'm doing, but considering Patrick's the artist who has to deal with it, I'll let him answer.
Well, Josh is putting together the script in an interesting sort of visual thing where he'll sort of have the word balloons on a page and his rough idea of where the panels are going to go. And of course, you know, he's a storyteller, himself, so I'm able to look at that and kind of get an idea of where he's going with the story. And Josh has also been nice in providing a lot of deep background reference material for me as we go. So that's been extraordinarily helpful. And so then I'll just look at that and start from there and ignore most of it and end up...
Got a story about that, but keep going.
And no, I'll end up with a good page, and then we'll do a bit of back and forth because I certainly am not a, you know, it's got to be done my way or the highway kind of artist. So we'll go back and forth a little bit over design, but generally, what I've been able to do is take his narration and dialogue, and you know, really bare. Panel ideas that he sends and just kind of run with it and add a lot of texture and detail to the world. And, you know, I'll send him stuff and surprise him every once in a while. But usually what he's written has implied enough that that we're completely in sync. And it's been a good process, a different process for me. I'm used to the last really big project I did was a thing from Archaea called Starkweather Immortal. And the writer on that, the very talented Dave Rodriguez, wrote, you know, traditional comic book script. And that's what I'm used to working on. And that was, you know, 140 pages. So I got a lot of experience doing that one, too. And so going from that to this has been a really interesting and nice change of pace. I've enjoyed it, and I don't think I have a preference for one way or the other, but this has really worked well.
Actually, interesting thing is a lot of the stuff that I sent to Patrick closely resembles the working draft of my own script. So when I write for myself, you know, I write the kind of the full script where the art notes are just to myself, and then the second draft is this very visual rough of just kind of a layout with speech bubbles on the page and where figures and people would go and their photo references. And then from that, the finished art is created. So it's interesting. Almost everything Patrick's gotten is that working draft of references and layout with text included. But the story about, you know, just a hint of how good Patrick is, and I'm going to say it, I'm going to keep saying it to everyone out there. You may not recognize the name Patrick McAvoy, but I promise you he's one of your favorite artists. You just don't know it. You own his art. You like his art. You probably have quite a bit of his art on your shelf and don't know it. Called Cthulhu. Anyway. He did that Cthulhu Wants You poster that everyone just loves, and no one knows that it was Patrick. But anyway, the thing that really woke me up to the fact that how good he is, you know, I've done a lot of layout and lettering for other friends of mine who've worked with A-list artists. And, you know, the sign of a really good artist is if I don't feel like lettering is this juggling act of shoving and cramming words behind the art, or somehow when the art works with the speech bubbles and narration, that is a good artist. And there's been multiple times where Patrick has gone completely off script and sent me pages, and I'm like, oh Jesus Christ, how the hell am I gonna, this is not even anything like I requested, how am I gonna, and then I start putting the speech bubbles in, and I'm like, wow, this is better. This works even better. So that's how I know he is really good.
Well, I can thank you very much, Josh. That's awfully nice to say. I can say that I'm a big evangelist and follower of Alex Toth, and he. Before he passed away, he did a lot of work on a website. He never used a computer himself, but the folks who ran the website would send him pieces of his art, and he would write copious handwritten notes. And the website's still up. I think it's called tothfans.com. And he just, you know, out of the goodness of his heart and his spare time, gave all of us artists who were willing to look a masterclass in his storytelling technique. And the thing that really opened my eyes on there, and this was maybe 10 years ago I started reading that, was how important the word balloons are to the layout and how the word balloons are where everything starts. So whenever I begin laying out a page, I'll always begin with, you know, a rough idea in my head of where the visuals are going to go. But the first thing I jot down is the size and placement of the word balloons to help take you through a page. And then I'll draw the pictures around that. And I think that's vitally important. And I got that whole technique from the great Alex Toth.
As you brought up Alex Toth, I was going to ask what your artistic influences are, not just for this project, but overall when you're working on, you know, like the fantasy stuff or the role-playing stuff, things like that.
Oh, well, sure. You'll be sorry you asked that because I could go on for hours. I'll try to edit myself.
You know, Patrick, that's one of the most fun hanging out with you is getting you started on this stuff.
Thanks. Like I said before, I'm a huge fan of illustration, the history of illustration in general, especially from about 1890 on. And it shaped my technique and, you know, the things that I like from the very beginning of when I was doing art. Sort of as a kid, I got into Frank Frazetta and a lot of the great comics artists of the 60s and illustrators of the time, you know, Jeff Jones and people like that, because my mom had all of this great science fiction stuff she would read. And so growing up, I had all of these covers and things, you know, like the Frazetta, you know, John Carter art and things like that. So that was all sitting around the house, and I really got into, you know, classic sci-fi fantasy book cover illustration along with the comic book illustration illustrators of, you know, 70s and 80s and 60s. Really, my main influences for painting are Frazetta. Of course, it's, you know, a lot of it starts there. But also, N.C. Wyeth, I'd have to say, is probably the greatest illustrator of the 20th century. His use of color and form, you can see in a lot of what I do badly. And then, in terms of comics artists, probably Will Eisner. I really cut my teeth reading old Spirit reprints from Will Eisner's Spirit from the 1940s. Jim Steranko for his creativity and amazing layouts. And probably Bill Sienkiewicz for his ability to just try something different virtually every panel. Really doesn't get a lot better than that. Oh, and I should mention Steranko also, his book cover art, again, going into book covers, is spectacular in a completely different way from his comic book art. If you haven't seen the things he's done with full acrylic paintings, it's a real eye-opener. He did the whole reprint Shadow series in the 1970s, where he did, I don't know, I think like 40 or 50 covers for them. So, yeah, I guess that's a little sampler, a little smattering. If you don't want me to go on for 3 or 4 hours, I better stop there.
Well, Josh, I'm going to ask the same question of you, but I want to come at it. One of the things that I've really liked about the work that I've read from you is you don't seem to be drawn from that I want to be Stan Lee feel that a lot of comic writers tend to start with. Your work seems to have a very hard science fiction core to it. With Titanium Rain is about a civil war in China in 2031, and it deals with hard science fiction. Utopiates is just a fascinating idea that I imagine you probably wanted to play with forever.
Yes.
Where you could get a personality through a drug. And so I wanted to ask what your influences were. And when you come into comics, most people, when you say comics, they say superheroes. I wanted to ask why you thought, you know, I can bring hard science fiction ideas into comic books. So there's a long, complicated question.
Sure. Why did I think I want to bring hard science fiction concepts to comics? Because I had the insane notion people would read them. It was only later that I found out that the regular LCS reading public actually has an aversion and actually a real hate relationship with hard science fiction entering comics. Didn't learn that till much, much later through David Brin, who kind of expressed similar feelings. I don't know if you're familiar with that author.
I'm familiar with him, but I didn't know he had much to do with comics, to be honest.
He actually did what I did. He tried. I think my odds are a bit better because times are changing. It's no longer the 80s. But, yeah, Brin tried to do the same thing. He tried to bring hard SF, and not just hard SF, but, you know, human SF, science fiction to comics. The Capes and Tights crowd really did not take kindly to his kind coming around, which is rather unfortunate because he's an incredible writer. How did I get started? My influences, I'd say it started really for me with William Gibson. I'd read Neuromancer when I was a teenager, and it was one of those books I kept returning to. And the older I got, the more I saw in it. But then also as it went on, there was John Shirley, Jeff Noon, Walter John Williams, you know, a lot of, you know, sci-fi author or cyberpunk authors of the 80s. And then it went further back to Harlan Ellison, incredible writer, one of my personal heroes now, Philip K. Dick. You know, just there was, you know, this very rich power to that kind of storytelling where you take that one impossible idea or fantastic idea and drop it into reality. Stylistically, Gibson always has been an influence as, who else would you say?
Oh, definitely Jeff Noon.
Yeah, Jeff Noon, kind of the rhythm of his writing. I don't know if you're familiar with him at all. He's a English writer from Manchester who's just got an incredible way with rhythmic storytelling. So he has this sci-fi that reads like music. It's incredible. And I really liked that hard-edged, intellectual but still gripping sci-fi. I mean, the Golden Age is an enjoyable era for sci-fi, but it is very cold and very just too much intellectualism and not enough, you know, humanity at the same time for me a lot. So that was really my start as far as writing was concerned, and that's always stuck with me. I think then the visual storytelling, I was really taken with the work of Mamoru Oshii, who did Ghost in the Shell, Jinro, Skycrawlers, which is an incredible, incredible film. And I'm a visual person. I see a lot of things visually in my mind. For a long time, I tried to write novels, but what would I do in my free time? When I was working normal jobs, while I was at my desk, I was drawing these funny little comics. When I was at home, just screwing around, I was drawing comics. I read comics. And, you know, finally, I realized, no, this is what I should be doing. I should be creating comics. And I'm convinced, you know, the landscape's changing. Kickstarter's opened the door. The web has opened the door. Geek culture has expanded, blown up, and changed. I believe now there is room for gripping, intelligent sci-fi and satire in comics. It's just we've got to bring the audience in. They've got to be let into the room and not chased out.
Another thing that I've noticed, I followed the sales figures, and really, this is, in my opinion, the broadest time for comics since possibly the early 80s direct market boom, where, yeah, we're not having a whole bunch of stuff that sells over 100,000. But if you look, there's a lot of different things that are selling 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,000.
Right.
That you can make a go of it with, especially with repackaging work. Okay, it comes out as a comic, then it comes out as a hardcover, then it comes out as a paperback. You can get it into bookstores. One of the things you did that just blew my mind was you did a radio play of Titanium Rain.
That was a great experience. That actually was kind of a realization of a dream. One of the first serious attempts I made at getting published is I had gotten very into the big Finnish audio productions coming out of England, and they had an open call. And I tried repeatedly to get on board with that because I love the medium. You know, events just lined up. A number of Comic-Cons ago, back when I was still doing signings at the Arkea booth, this guy comes out of the crowd, and he'll hate me for this, but he looked dead like Reggie Bannister of the Phantasm films. You know, at first glance, I'm like, oh, hey, it's Reggie Bannister. Look, hey, cool. I love it. And he comes up and he says, are you Josh Finney? I go, yeah. And he goes, how do you feel about audio drama? And I start talking to this guy, and very quickly I realize, no, this isn't Reggie. It turns out to be Lance Axt. He's part of a company called the Audio Comics Company, or ACC. And he really, really wanted to do Utopias. Him and Bill DeFreeze, which is he's an amazing director and a kind of a star in the audiobook realm, started this company because they wanted to expand and take radio drama further. They have a vision of evolving it, taking it out of the 40s traditionalism and creating these more interactive, modern adventures. And they said, we love Utopias. We love where you're going. They kept using the phrase Philip K. Dick, which I'll take that compliment. I'm not going to say no to that. Thank you. It was tied up at the time for reasons I can't mention and don't want to. So I said, well, I own just about everything for Titanium Rain except the book rights. I can do that. And literally within 9 months, we were in the studio. And I don't know if you're aware of this, Titanium Rain was such a different experience, audio speaking. It was such a leap forward. It's gotten a lot of acclaim and a lot of attention in the audiobook and audio drama circles. Audiophile magazine named it one of the audio dramas of the year. We just won the Mark Time Award, which was put together by the Firesign Theater guys. We were nominated for 2 Audies, which are the Oscars of audio drama. That hack Neil Gaiman, whoever the hell he is, won. He beat us. I don't know why that is, but
he's some local author here in the Minneapolis.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why it is.
I think he's got a comic coming out soon, but nobody's paying much attention.
Yeah, so yeah, whatever. So we lost out to this Gaiman guy, but but yeah,
he is promising.
But yeah, it had done so well. It really has turned a lot of heads, and it's kind of redefined what can be done with the medium. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with working with Bill DeFreeze, the director, the freedom he gave to me, humoring a lot of my bizarre requests, but it worked out quite well. So yeah,
it came out great. It's wonderful. I can attest to it as a completely unbiased third party.
No, completely unbiased. Well, actually, just to try to, you know, bring things back a little bit, you know, Josh mentioned you're revolutionizing the medium. And just going back to Kaiju, one of the things that we wanted to do was to give people a book that nobody had, you know, seen done before. I mean, you know, everybody's seen, you know, the normal panel layout and other things. But besides the fact that, you know, comics is a visual medium, we really wanted to push that envelope. And, you know, Patrick, you know, totally took it in an awesome direction with
that.
Well,
we needed it to be cinematic. It needed to have that feel of a 1960s Toho Studios extravaganza, which they were. They were incredible. Mm-hmm.
Well, we thought as long as we're doing something, you know, for us, something that we like, we might as well play with the visuals too. And we thought, well, you know, this is going to show up on people's computers and mobile devices. That's where the world's heading. So from the word go, we said, well, let's first of all just turn the comics page on its side, and we'll do a widescreen book, and we'll print it widescreen, and we'll design with people's computers in mind. So we did the entire thing in that format, which I think works much better for comics online. I really think everybody's going to start to move in that direction.
Well, I know that you nearly pissed yourself when you saw the way it looked on the iPad.
Yeah, that's right, nearly.
Yeah, we were at the con. You hosed all over the place.
That's right. Had to bring a mop. No, we designed from the word go to look really, you know, it's going to print out just fantastic because we're going to have, you know, very high quality printing values, but it's just got a glow to it on the computer because we're going for something that is going to look fantastic on everybody's mobile device. So that was something really new and different that I think we've been excited about from the word go. Plus the fact that we're not going for monthly comic distribution. We're direct to graphic novel. And I think more and more people are doing that these days. And it's something we're going to have to get used to, I think, in the future. And it's a better business model, I think, and a better creative model because we don't have to artificially fit into the monthly paradigm.
Another thing about the wide dimension or widescreen version of the page, you know, the way we're doing these pages, originally the intent was, you know, this will look great on mobile devices and screens. But what became apparent immediately, and I believe Patrick can definitely speak to this, was, you know, again, we're aiming for these very larger-than-life 60s kaiju movie imagery. And turning the panel on its side, the widescreen perspective allowed Patrick artistically to recapture seeing something on the big screen. Rather than having tall panels, they're all wide panels, like a movie screen, which you kind of need for monsters that are longer than taller, you know?
And obviously people have been doing, you know, quote, widescreen comics for several years now to various degrees of success. You know, some people like, say, Brian Hitch are fantastic at it, and other people just, you know, they're sort of forced into that by their editors. But the problem with it, of course, is just the format of comics is a tall page, and then you put wide panels in there, and everything's scrunched up. You know, people are all stooping to fit into the panels. It looks kind of odd after a while. And I've tried it myself. And, you know, it's an interesting idea, but it doesn't really fit the format. So just by the simple act of turning the book on its side, it was like, duh, okay, turn it on its side. We finally found, hey, wait a minute. Now this widescreen thing is fantastic. And it's much better to do giant monsters stepping on cities that way.
Yes. Well, the other thing I've found as a writer, flipping the book on its side and allowing for wide panels is a lot easier to write for. It's a lot friendlier to the narrative, and I think it's a lot closer to how we see. You know, we don't see the world in tall, narrow panels. We see the world, you know, horizontally.
Yeah. We see the world naturally on a wide screen.
Yeah.
So there we go. Yeah, that's been really freeing for both of us, all of us in it. So we're excited about that. And also again, doing it directly to the graphic novel, I think was one of the best decisions we made.
Yeah.
Now, Patrick's going to be leaving us, but Patrick, I want to ask one last question before you go.
Oh, no, yeah, we're losing you. Don't...
Yeah,
what has been your favorite thing to draw, be it a panel, a page, a character? As you're putting this together, what's your favorite thing to draw?
Wow, that is a good, difficult question because I've enjoyed all of it. And I'm tempted to say something trite like, well, it's the next page I'm going to do. but I would say my very, very favorite thing so far has been one of the monsters. And I I don't know if I should give everything away. Let's see.
Are you talking about Armadillo?
Actually, he's one of my favorites, but he's not my very favorite. Let me. I'm going to go see if it's up on the. On the site yet? If we've given him away yet?
The Russian monsters are up on the site now.
Ah, good.
Oh, and that site is worldwarkaiju.com.
Oh no. Okay. Oh well, Kamador is not up yet, but I guess I can give.
Go ahead.
Him away. So anyway, there's one called Kamador that I just love. I fell in love with him. He's he's our version of Gamera.
And, okay.
Jeez, you should have told me that. I'll write him in more.
Oh, he's absolutely. I am in love with that character. He's so cute. He's the original Gamera is sort of just a generic turtle creature. You know, he's like the he's an iconic turtle. He's sort of what you would think of if you gave somebody a pencil and said draw a turtle, and they'd sort of do that. But I decided to make mine really a specific loggerhead turtle, and I found they have this really just cute smile on their face. And so I get to draw the neat loggerhead scales, and then I gave him some giant mandibles, of course, but and then he's got just as cute a smile. So I'm in love with Kamador. That's I can't wait to do more of him. But
actually,
yeah,
we're using a Kamador as our mascot for Team Kaiju on the Kickstarter.
Yeah, that's why I wasn't sure if I should give him away yet. Yeah, if you go to the Kaiju Kickstarter page and look where Team Kaiju is actually a picture of Kamador's cute smiling face. So I love him. But I, you know, on the opposite side also, I love a character we have called Razorbeak, who yes. is sort of the most evil of the Kaiju. And he's just mean. I tried to make him look almost like a vampire Kaiju. His wings are like Dracula's cape, and he is a messy eater. We'll just say that.
Okay.
But I've liked so much of this. That's a tough question, but I think I've fallen in love with a number of the characters, and so I love being able to do them.
Well, Patrick, thanks for joining us. I know you have to go.
Yeah.
Thanks for being part of my first interview.
Oh, hey, it's been great. And you did a fantastic job. You should do a little more of this in the future. You might.
Why, thank you.
Might you have bring him on to have talk about podcast. His gaming art.
What's that?
You should have Cat Patrick come back on to talk about just his experience as a fantasy artist. Seriously.
Ooh, I would not say no.
Okay, that sounds great.
Well, it's been really great, guys. Thanks a lot. I'll talk to you later.
Take care, Patrick.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
Bye, Patrick.
Bye.
At that point, Patrick left, and I think that's a good stopping point. I don't want to have epic, you know, word balloon 3-hour episodes. But we continued to talk, and it's just Josh, Kat, and I talking. And we talk about comics, and we talk more about World War Kaiju, and we talk about our favorite crime TV shows and science fiction novels and things like that. I want your feedback. First off, I want you to go to the website and sign up for their Kickstarter. Why? I really want this book to come out. I've promoted a few Kickstarters, and all of them have been things I want to see. And this is another one that I want to see. I want this book. I want this book in my hands. I want to own this book. I want to read this book. I love the idea, and I really hope that they're able to get their stretch goals, because their stretch goals, it's more story, rather than, oh, and you get some stickers, and you get a window cling. No, you get more story. So I'm excited about it. The second part will be up tomorrow, so look forward to that. If you have any feedback for Solitaire Rose Radio, I want to get it. I want to know what you think. I want to know what questions you would have asked. I want to know, did I come off as a good interviewer? So you can email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. You can also call, and I will play your message on the podcast. And that number is 952-856-0519. Yes, it's a Google Voice number. Leave your message, and it'll be played on the air. Also, this here podcast has sponsors, and it's not World War Kaiju. It's the sponsor we all know, the sponsor we all love, DreamHost.com. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail because we're near the end of the podcast, but DreamHost.com is my web host. They should be your web host. If you need a website, you need to go to DreamHost.com. And if you use the code CRAZY, K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year. So go to DreamHost.com, get yourself a website. Also, go to WorldWarKaiju.com, support their Kickstarter. I want this book. Well, I think that's everything. I'm going to go get pie.